Hi, this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hey, this is Katrina with Zooming in the Lens, and I'm here with my friend Kara again. Hey, Kara.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good. The super moon was last night. I don't know when this podcast will come out, but wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Were you able to see it from New York?
Of course.
Yeah. We weren't really, actually. I mean, in the part of LA that I'm in, it was too cloudy.
Oh, really? I have a friend that I just visited in Maine, and there's a spot in Maine that's closest to the highest elevation where you actually see the sunrise first in the whole United States. And we went up there to look at just the views, which are breathtaking, and he's got photos from that moon from that spot. You look like you're right underneath the moon.
Wow. It was powerful. I mean, when the clouds started to part a little bit, I was able to see some of it, and I was watching it also on my phone through the Hubble telescope on NASA TV. So I was able to be a part of it as well. So, yeah, I loved that. So, Zooming in the Lens, I think the title of this one is going to be Game of Incarnation. What does that title even mean to you, Kara? She's giving me a face right now. I can see her on Skype.
You can pull that apart and put that back together. Game, I mean, literally or figuratively.
Yeah.
So many ways to look at life and why we're here and question our purpose and our being and who we are in our own life. Are we a player in the game?
Yeah, you would never think, right, that somebody would think of life as a game. Like, in general, we take things really seriously. It's my life. It's my career. It's my, as a baby, my teddy bear. Everything we start coming out is my. You never really get that, the game of incarnation. Well, incarnation, for one, is we are incarnated. You know, it sounds like such a biblical term, but it's a really great way to describe how we as humans are here. This is an incarnation. We're alive and we're incarnated onto this planet. So it almost seems like an oxymoron, game of incarnation. I mean, subliminally, because who would think that incarnation would ever be a game, like I said.
Well, there is a game of life. Remember that game?
I do.
You just have a little car with little pink and blue pegs, and you rode around life, and you got things, and you bought things.
Yeah, and that's to tell you something about my personality. As a child, I never wanted to play that game because it was so long.
We used to flip the kids out of the car.
The game of life is so long.
It was long. I wonder if the people that created it were like really spiritual and said, oh yeah, let's like make this game really long so it's like long like life.
Yes. Yeah, and on one hand, it's not long at all. I mean, there is some truth to when you get to that benchmark of 40, things do start to speed up a little bit. I don't think there's any truth to it in like a time linear fashion. I think what happens is we get more and more experiences and there we get maybe a little tightly gripped on the roles we have in life being very serious and, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 and A, B, and then you say C. And so there's very little room for creation and experience. And so you get to the point quicker. And so the older you get, you start to lose that curiosity about life. And so, of course, time is going to feel like it's going quicker because you're just playing it out. You're not even playing it out. Let's just say it's happening.
I think you get robotic, though.
That's
you,
probably a better word for what I'm trying to say.
When you're younger and you're playing and you're carefree, I mean, we say that all the time, you know, you lose your imagination a little bit, and you lose your all those curious things that kids have. They skip along. We don't skip when we're adults because we're thinking and we're serious.
That's right.
It's a whole different way to go about things.
Yeah. So that subject, game of incarnation, seemed like a really cool one for you and I to dig into. And it, you know, I read this. I'm going to say his name probably horribly wrong, so I apologize to anybody that actually knows how to pronounce it. But there's a guy named Dr. O'Laori. So I'll spell it. It's O apostrophe capital L A O I R E. So if there's somebody out there that knows how to pronounce that, my dyslexic brain is having a very difficult time with that. O'Laori. Let's say that. This guy's pretty awesome. He's a PhD in transpersonal psychology, which sounds like a really fancy title, but he's got really amazing ways of explaining things. He's also a clinical psychologist. He is in Los Altos, California, and actually, I think, was a Seventh-day Adventist priest. But he's a different kind of priest. You know, he's a different kind of clergy, which I'm finding is becoming, you know, more and more common. There's another gentleman that I think is on the website functionalyogaonline.com that is in Minnesota, and he's a Christian priest, but he's into mysticism and science and spirituality, and he's using religion as a vehicle in which to talk about things like the game of incarnation. But that's another gentleman. This guy here, he has this piece that I just really wanted to share with you, Kara, because it's the discovery into how we rely and have defined science as the absolute. It almost seems like, and I don't know, you might not feel this way, but it feels like even men in particular get shoved into that category of being more on the scientifical. That's funny. The scientific side of it and logical side of it, and the women might be a little bit more spiritual. I don't believe that to be true at all. I just think it's maybe more men. It just seems like more men would be into that. Anyway, I don't think that it needs to be one or the other. I think that there really are links that we could discuss into the game of incarnation. And this gentleman will say this way better than I will, but it's to learn how to play the game of life where we're taking skillful action and we have intention, and the relationship starts with the self. And none of it could really be proven. So it's not working really from the mind's job. And then you look at science and we think that it is all a mind's job, but we're forgetting about scientists and studies and how much they don't know, these scientists, while they're doing this research. There's a whole leg of science that all we're hearing is the end result. But when you become a scientist, you don't become the scientist saying, well, I'm a result. Every day I get results. These people are doing like a mini version of the game of incarnation in their job, because every day they're in there and they get no result over and over and over and over again.
Right.
And in spirituality, at least in some schools of thought, you're getting comfortable with the idea of not knowing. So there's a lot more in common. That's just one thing, you know, of science and spirituality and not taking them apart. So this O'Leary article, he says, what are the rules of the game of incarnation? When you sign up for incarnation, you become part of this experiment. One of the rules is that we have to learn to infer from our experiences how the system works. Inference is the ability to draw conclusions from and to recognize patterns in our experiences. One of the primary experiences is realizing that the physical universe in which we live in is in fact just the printout of a metaphysical universe. The Greeks had two words for universe: cosmos with a C, meaning the physical universe in which we find ourselves, and cosmos with a K, meaning the metaphysical undergirdling that's responsible for the physical articulation of the universe. The Greeks were attempting to infer the existence of the cosmos with a K from their experience of the cosmos with a C. They were also attempting to infer how the system worked so that they could play the game of incarnation properly. For example, the law of karma says that every action has a consequence. If you like the consequence, keep doing the action. If you don't like the consequence, stop doing the action. To learn to play the game, we have to become scientists of spirituality. The typical scientific method is that the scientist will amass a bunch of observations and data and begin to recognize patterns, create a hypothesis to explain the patterns, and set up an experiment to test the hypotheses. If the hypothesis is correct, then it is repeated and replicated in other laboratories. If the results are the same, it becomes a new scientific principle. And we have to do that with our spirituality also. In the course of our observations, we have to be awake. We have to collect data from our experiences. We have to recognize patterns and laws and test them. We have to cross-reference them with other people's experience and then establish some kind of cosmology or new laboratory for ourselves. So we navigate through a system in a scientific fashion. Spirituality is a science that allows us to become mysticists, a word I coined many years ago. A mysticate is a cross between a mystic and a scientist. It's the ability to be scientific about spirituality as much as we are spiritual about science. By becoming mysticates, we opt for gnosis, not knowing, instead of just dogma. And the most important rule of all is the law of love. Ultimately, the only thing that works is love. We can try greed, violence, anxiety, fear, and anger. They all create other situations with more anger and more fear and more depression and more violence. The only thing demonstrably showing that the system improves is acting with love. Because ultimately, the evolutionary trajectory is a single safari that started in God's womb and ended in God's heart. Wow, huh?
You can read that about 500 times just to try and get through it line by line.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And I would like us to try to, you know, make some sense of this together. I go back to the recipe that he's laying out for scientists. And I look at it through a spiritual lens. If we want to learn to play the game, we have to become scientists of spirituality. Now, really digest that. Scientists of spirituality. Now, science may look like, because, you know, obviously people think science is, we've given it the title of they know everything. It's a scientific fact, you know? And we all walk around looking for these scientific facts. But the truth of science is the study of. And the truth of spirituality is the study of. Depending on what lineage you look at in spirituality, it could be the study of God. It could be the study of the universe. It could be the study of the self. There's a recipe that science is using, that spirituality is using. And even though science is more married to their system, that was that whole part that he read that I should have underlined so I can find it easier. But he says the typical scientific method is that the scientist will amass a bunch of observations and data and begin to recognize patterns. Okay, let's just take that line, for instance. In spirituality, when looking inside of ourselves to find grounding with the ever-changing world and not trying to find our freedom from the external sources of the new phone makes me feel great, so now I have a good day. Or now I'm in love, so it feels like my life is working great. Because when you're not in love or get broken up with, that means the opposite's going to happen. Then your life's not great. So there's all that up and down, which we witness. No one's saying that it stops from you just witnessing it. But the scientific experiment, much like how they are first recognizing patterns, we are cultivating the witness, and we are noticing. So you understand what I'm saying? It's too convoluted.
Well, wouldn't you say that science, in their notating data upon their experiments and looking for patterns, they're outcome-oriented. They're always looking for an outcome. They're always looking for to draw a conclusion. Mm-hmm. Where in spirituality, we're more... I think, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, don't you think there's a lot of people that aren't doing spirituality from that place, though? They want results.
Yes, that's my point. My point is, and I know I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong.
Right.
Because I think I started out on my spiritual journey looking for a result.
Oh my God,
it's when you realize that, but then it's when you realize you're not ever going to get a result, that you're like, okay, now I could just go along for the ride and keep watching, you know,
right,
and learn more about myself and the people around me. But that's, so they do start out with a similar, what did you call it?
System.
Method, pattern?
It's a system. Yeah, I mean, science has that system. We could start out. I think that's the point in it, is that we're looking at science and spirituality so separately.
And no, they're very similar. In the questing for the gathering the information, and they work, I think, from all the things that I've read and I'm looking at here, all the books and notes I've taken, all parallel, but I think that is maybe where they separate, that, you know, in spirituality, the time when you realize that you never really have an answer, a definitive.
Well, and even when you do in science, Kara, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but even when you do in science, it changes. I know, yes. I keep using the same example, but that example of, like, it's fine to smoke in your car with the windows rolled up, you know, when it was the 70s, I even think into the 80s, with your kids in the back seat.
Yes.
That was safe then. Well, you know what? If you go back, nobody even looked at the data of secondhand smoke. And if they did look at the data, obviously there was no conclusion that you could be killing your kids, because nobody would have done it, or most people wouldn't have done it.
Well, they weren't looking for the answer to begin with. They had the information from the experiment, from finding out that cigarette smoking caused cancer and all the damage in the smoke itself, but they didn't even look at secondhand smoke, I don't think, as an experimental factor at all. Until later on.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. But all I know is, I think what we're really discussing is our relationship to the word scientific and our relationship to the word spirituality and the judgments that come along with it, whether good or bad. And if there's balance in being scientific and there's balance in spirituality, I think this Olario, however his name is pronounced. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I think he's onto something with the system, the systematic approach of it. And I just sat down with his example of how what their recipe is of recognizing, you know, observing. Then science recognizes patterns, creates a hypothesis to explain the patterns, and then sets up an experiment to test the hypothesis. And then they do a bunch of other tests in different places. Well, think about the work that I'm in particularly doing, which my teacher Ram Dass has, you know, so beautifully has taught so many people. That is sort of a wonderful meeting in the middle of science and spirituality, where we're taking ourselves as object first. You know, so first you have to see that you're in prison, and that's not a bad thing. You know, I know it sounds horrible, but if you are liking a place that you go away on vacation because the weather is fantastic the entire time you're there and your vacation might get influenced by that, you are in prison. That's how easy it is to be in prison. All it really means is we are believing that the thoughts we are thinking, the things we like and don't like, our feelings are completely real and not relatively real. So if we're going to investigate the self, we have to start with the commentator. And most of us are thinking and never taking in accounting, never observing like science is. So it's not that far apart for somebody out there that might be more scientifically inclined to say, great, I'm scientifically inclined. I can just approach spirituality from that place. So we take this practical method that science gives us. Witnessing is like science amassing a bunch of data. What are you noticing when you look at yourself as a science experiment? What are you noticing that your mind is thinking? And without being thought, you need to create a little bit of distance from it to be able to get the data on it. Then they're recognizing patterns in the thought. In this lineage right now that we're practicing, that's our writing down of what our roles and our models are in life. I'm a mother, I'm a husband, I'm a teenage boy, I'm a whatever. I want to be this when I grow up, or I am this, I'm a banker, I'm a this. So we have to see the roles and the models. And that's science amassing a bunch of data. And then we create a hypothesis. That's the continuation that we have of noticing the thought instead of being it. And the hypothesis, whether you go the therapeutic angle of, I figured out that I'm like this because this happened, or if you go the spiritual route of, how does that serve me right now? Is it actually true? Do I actually still do that and feel that way? And if not, how do I let go of that which doesn't serve me? That's what science would do. They would be taking something, looking at it in a microscope and separating it. They have that, I wish I remember the name of it. I used to. Syphilage, or, Tyler would know that. Her son is this little genius guy. Syphilage or something alage, and it spins and spins and spins and it spins in the lab, and you get rid of all of the things that don't serve the purpose.
Yes, cool. It does end in laws.
It does, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And think about, we're doing that in our practice, but just slowly. We're slowly spinning everything to first notice what doesn't serve us any longer. Notice what is our original thought. Notice what we're carrying with us just because we're asleep in that thought process. And then they're replicating it. Science is replicating it in other labs. So you're doing all this, right? But then you're going out into the world and you're noticing your judgment of others. Your judgment in the supermarket of somebody who's packing their cart with all sugary foods and they're overweight. And so to you, to the thinking mind that wants answers, it would say, you eat sugary food, you end up fat. And there's no other room in there. There's no other space in there for there to be a thyroid issue, possible abuse that and trauma. And being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes doesn't literally mean that you have to have been overweight. It actually could mean, when in your life have you ever been food shopping or in a parking lot or at work and worried that somebody was looking at you, judging you? And how did that feel to you? Not great, I'm imagining. So in that moment of judging that, you're putting yourself in her position and remembering how it felt for you. Do you really want to give that back out? That's the replicating it in other labs. It doesn't matter how much it works for you in your house or at your puja table or when you're able to listen to Ram Dass or Alan Watts or Wayne Dyer or David G or any of the people. It's the action. And what is the action? It's the experience of it. So going out and bringing it into other labs is bringing it out into our daily life. And the yoga asana part, the physical part of it, if that doesn't get worked into being a part of that, and I don't mean in that you're doing physical postures or working out at a gym and you're thinking about your thought. I'm saying that you're using the physical practice as a way to create space so that when you're off the mat, space is more available when you're witnessing, when you're noticing your thoughts, when you're in the experiment of the self. You see, it's not really that far apart. Now, and yes, you're right. A lot of people start in spirituality and they do it because they want results. They want to stop anger. They want to stop cheating. They want to stop being so jealous. They want to heal from trauma in their past. Or something is just, they want a big change and they don't know how to do it and they're suffering it with guilt.
Well, that's a good place to start. There's nothing wrong with noticing all of those things need to be addressed.
Absolutely.
It's just that, like anything else, if you're moving into it with an expectation or that this is a quick fix or I'll read a few books and I'll be all better, you know, but that's things each person's individual journey and transformation. Mine's different than yours, and the next person we know, and the next person we know. So,
yeah, it makes me wonder how can asana, unless you're doing it for years and years and years, and you're literally doing what Iyengar has expressed, many other people have expressed, that when you're doing the physical practice, it's beating the shit so much out of your body that your mind quiets, and there is some, you know, relative biochemical evidence that anytime you're working out, you're not really thinking about your shopping list because you feel like you're going to die. You know, you're like, if you're lifting 300 pounds and benching or you're jogging or, but you're kicking your own ass or
you're shifting your focus. So in essence, really that's meditation. I mean, meditation doesn't have to be, David G said, He crossed his legs as he stood there in front of everybody and he put his hands in this mudra and he said, this is not a thought repellent. If you think it is, you're completely wrong. In other words, you can be, like we've said before, washing the dishes, mowing the lawn. That can be your yoga. When you're focusing on something else, and you're not listening to the chatter in your brain, you're technically meditating. He suggested people just do candle gazing. Watch the flame flicker. You know, get your eyes set on something else. So I just think that with this type of practice, and yes, there's the spirituality and science are completely connected. There's just a, just as there's different thought processes and teachings and spirituality, different books you read, so their methods are different, the lineages are different, the modalities are different, just as with science.
Yeah.
Science's experiments are different, and the way they conduct their experiments are different, and the way they list out their processes to which they come out with the hypothesis are different. Right. So,
and I think it's sometimes the whole result thing is delivered to new yogis or new spiritual people too soon, because I say if you're thinking that you're doing something for a result, go ahead and think that. Just keep noticing it. Don't say, oh, I can't start these things because I am totally result-oriented. It's just how we're groomed, and it's what the mind's job is to figure things out and keep you safe and keep your lineage going. And so don't wait for that. I think that's a place that eventually you come to, because if you don't get rid of the result, you're trying to ground to the ever-changing external parts, and it gets depressing. A practice will get like, well, I did this, why aren't I getting that? And you'll have enough of that beating up of yourself that you then are brought to this practice of non-result. I mean, the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scripture, is also a beautiful blend of science and spirituality. I mean, I don't think there's a podcast that's gone back, you know, that I haven't mentioned the Gita. It really is a daily way to live your life. I just saw this recipe that this gentleman was like laying out there, and he is right. We have to look at the patterns of that which we're spiritualizing, because you're one, right? Your true self, your heart, whatever you want to call it, your God nature, Buddha nature, it doesn't need spiritualizing. It is spiritual. It already is. It's us allowing for to see that. It's making space enough so you can loosen the screw just a little bit so that the two could blend in together. And you know what? Sometimes we go too far and you get the woo-woo, airy-fairy people that are like, I'm going to cross the street in like crazy traffic because the universe is going to provide for me. No, you're probably going to get hit by a car. But I value that as much as I value going all the way the other way too, because I say to show up as you are. And if you're being really truthful, brutally honest with yourself, we all end up at the same place. So whatever your path is, I'm not saying that this scientific patterning is right, or that you should definitely take this into your spirituality. But if there's no spirituality, but you're aligning yourself as a spiritual person, which you are if you're listening to this podcast, I don't know why you would be listening to it if you didn't feel like you were, or you're one of those people that say, I don't like religion. I don't like the duality. I don't like people saying that there's God and I have to, you know, do whatever he says. And that's like so common, right? I align myself more with being a spiritual person. Okay, well, what does that mean to you? Well, it just means that I believe that, you know, we're all energy, or we're all coming from the same place. And then it ends the conversation. That's the invitation right there. Because you're opposing one thing to make another thing, but you're not investigating the other thing to even know what that is. And it's something different for everybody. So why not start with a recipe like science is offering us of looking at ourselves as the experiment? Because whoever you take yourself into, whatever part of you you're bringing into that yoga class or into that lecture or into that silent retreat, that's really what matters. If I go into a lecture with Katrina, the commentator, Katrina too, you know, Katrina, the personality, likes and dislikes, and a teacher's voice annoys me, or I feel like they're talking about a bunch of shit I already know, or they're, you know, this is so above my head, I can't keep up. You're not going to remember half of it. It's going to feel great maybe at the moment or bad at the moment. And then you walk out and you're like, now I don't know how to keep this or how to work this into my daily life. Because the commentator is just already on to the next thing. When can I go to the next lecture? When can I get this person's book? When can I then go and do this? If we can cultivate the space to see who shows up in us at these lectures and be just, wow, interesting. Interesting that Katrina's there and that she's saying that and she's saying that. I know it sounds like disassociation from like a Peter Levine trauma way, but it's not disassociation. It's not disconnection. It's space. It's just enough space that you could zoom the lens in to yourself and how you're showing up in the moment to your comfort level, and then a little past that, and then, and then, and then, and then, and then. And I love that as a recipe to start. Some people may be so advanced that they're thinking, oh, that's so sophomoric, I don't want to go back to that. But I would beg to differ with the, I think we should all be able to keep visiting lots of things over and over again, just like science is. They're, you know how many times they do an experiment? To see if they get the same result. That's my favorite quote of sitting under an apple tree waiting for an orange to fall. How many of us are sitting out there going, I hate my job, but I just don't have any other choice. I don't know what else to do. You sure did. For how long, Kara?
15 years.
And now you're free? And what does that feel like?
It feels great. You know, I like to think of myself now as open to anything happening. Mm-hmm. And I don't live with regret. So I'll look back 15 years being unhappy. So why did I need to stay there for 15 years? Because I knew I was unhappy. I verbalized it to friends and family. How many times you heard it? Mm-hmm. And you know what? After a while, you even get sick of hearing yourself say it.
No, I'm sorry. Say that over again, because you just lost a connection.
What is it in us as humans that do something we do not enjoy and continue to do it?
A lot of elements to that.
And over again for countless days, months, years. It's different for everybody.
Yeah.
Whether it's a relationship or it's a job, or we all do it or have done it at one time, I think. And then you look back, and now that I'm in such a better place, did I not think I could get to this place 3 months ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10, you know, it's, I don't know. It's something you learn about yourself. That's all I can say. You do it for as long as you can do it, or as long as you need to. And believe me, you just need to for some reason, and you might not know what that is right away.
That's right. That's right. Yes, you're totally right. I think we all do it. I think that's part of the human incarnation. That's part of the game. If you take it really, really seriously, we're most likely going to be really unhappy. It's finding that play, you know, that element of that we're looking at ourselves as an experiment. I always loved that episode of Twilight Zone. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's two people, and I'm probably remembering it wrong, but the whole gist of it was there was people talking, and when they panned out at the end of the episode, you realize that the humans were in a cage. And the aliens.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? The aliens were doing scientific testing on us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, what's the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Then we are all insane.
Absolutely.
That's right. And, you know, in regards to science and spirituality having this connection, there is this drive in both of them to find the visible within the invisible. And if we look at our game of incarnation as like a scavenger hunt without the quick movement part of the scavenger hunt, and replacing that with the observer or the noticing and the allowing, you're looking at finding the visible within the invisible. Well, how the hell do I do that? If it's invisible, I can't see it. Well, there's lots of things that we can't see that we've already accepted.
Oh, yeah.
Like wind and air. I mean, you could see wind when it moves the trees, but what if the trees weren't there? You could feel it. So maybe it's a more of a feeling thing. You're not even paying attention to when we blink or how we're breathing. How is this body breathing without me controlling it? How am I blinking? How does my eyes know to blink? I mean, I'm not talking about the science behind it. I'm saying, look at how much is already not visible. Where, yes, it feels like a leap to try to find the invisible, try to find the visible when it's invisible, but that can translate into this Krishnamurti.
That would be a very good exercise to do. Just have a notepad, and every time you think of something that you know and you just accept that is invisible, non-tangible, write it down, and then compare notes.
That is what my students in Zooming in the Lens do. And it's been really helpful.
Mm.
And they're, you know what it builds? It builds curiosity, like, what else don't I know? And what else don't I know? What else don't I know? And you just get curious. Yeah, so maybe in a way we are that Twilight Zone episode where we're both in the cage, and we are also the aliens on the outside investigating what's in the cage. And what's in the cage doesn't even know that it's being
investigated.
Investigated. Thank you. Thank you. It doesn't even know. So listen to this, Krishnamurti. I generally look at my wife, husband, at a person with all my prejudices and memories. Through those memories, I look. That is the center from which I look. So he's saying his memories is where he basically is looking at everybody in his life from. Therefore, the observer is different from the thing observed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you got that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, we all do that.
Oh, every human, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I generally look at my wife, husband, and a person with all my prejudices and memories. Now, don't think good or bad here. You're looking at a person with all goodness because you looked at them yesterday with all goodness. That's not showing up in the moment. That's expecting somebody to be the exact same every single day.
Mm-hmm. And are you?
And are you. And so we're looking at these people. You cannot see the unseen when you think you know what you're seeing. So that's the prison. That's what I feel from that Gurdjieff quote as well. Knowing that you're in prison is different than just being in it. And in order to break out of prison, you have to first know you're in it. So in that process, he goes on, he says, in that process, thought is constantly interfering through association and with the rapidity of the association. now, when I realize the whole implication of that instantly, there is an observation without the observer. That's being present in the now. Can Kara and I just be looking at each other on Skype right here, right now, without all the thoughts of who Kara is to me, what Kara means, the good feelings that I get from seeing Kara because I've known her my entire life, that we connect well? Can I see with a capital S Kara without the mind saying, go to sleep, Katrina. You know this person. You don't have to see anything in real time. I'll take care of it for you. I'll fill in all the blanks, and you just get on with your agenda. And it makes us have to arrive in every moment with ourselves and others with an agenda. So he goes on to say, it's very simple to do this with trees, with nature, but with human beings, what takes place? If I can look at my wife or my husband non-verbally, not as an observer, it's rather frightening, isn't it? Because my relationship with her or with him is quite different. It is not in any sense personal. So it kind of takes out the personal part of it when you can see somebody like that. It is not a matter of pleasure, and I am afraid of it. I can look at a tree without fear because it is fairly easy to commune with nature, but to commune with human beings is much more dangerous and frightening. My relationship undergoes a tremendous revolution. Before, I possessed my wife and she possessed me. Like, we like being possessed, he says. And I just want to say that to me, what he's saying there is, when you have a preconceived notion and an expectation that somebody's going to arrive to you in the way that you know them, it's like where the word possessed is being used as, sorry, I'm losing my words. Your reliability. That's the word I'm looking for. Reliability. Before I possessed my wife, before my wife was reliably always Carol and, you know, slightly airy, but really loving, or always a bitch, or we get very comfortable and almost are in ownership of our thoughts of who people are in our lives. The roles and the models they fill become reliable to us. And so I think when he says we liked being possessed, we walk around and we say, she really knows me. He really knows me. He's the only one I can talk to. Oh, man, her? Oh, my, man. They're the only ones that really get me. We as human beings feel like that's getting us, but that's not getting us. That's getting our incarnation. That's getting our personality. That's us falling in love with each other based on the changing parts of ourselves. So that's why I feel Krishnamurti is saying it could be very scary to do this because it feels like you're in no man's land. Seeing somebody every day for the first time. And that's not reliable. And what the mind wants is repetition. It wants to know what it knows. And the minute we have to meet each other without knowing, it's really scary. He says, he goes on to say, we were living in our own isolated self-identifying space. In observing, I removed that space. I am now directly in contact. I look without the observer and therefore without a center. Unless one understands this whole problem, merely to develop a technique of looking becomes frightful. Then one becomes cynical and all the rest of it. That's Krishnamurti.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too, because what he's doing is taking the recipe of science and spirituality, and he's saying, here's why we don't want to do it. Here's why you might listen to this and go, that doesn't make any sense to me. Or, you know, you'll push it away when you're not ready. Even when you are, sometimes it might push away. So if you just...
I feel like, you know, we may need to get a part two in on this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So much more to be said, and I have, like, piles of things I think are so interesting.
And I so want to hear that. So, yeah, let's do a part two of that. So quickly, I just want to tell you that Zooming in the Lens Group 3 is now being formed, which I'm really psyched about.
Yay!
And, yeah, Ram Dass and I and Love, Serve, Remember Foundation are coming together again to do a Group 3. It's going to be a suggested donation this time. And if you want to know more about the course, we're also making a bunch of YouTubes now, cutting them up. What a practice that is. Oof. Seeing yourself doing all this stuff really brings out the rascal in me, I'll tell you. So go to functionalyogaonline.com, and you can also go to, as of October 5th, the registration will be open on ramdass.org/zooming. And you'll register through Ram Dass, but I really, really suggest that you go to functionalyogaonline.com first and read about it, because it's very different, this course. You fill out questionnaires, and there's a process, because we're putting people into like-minded groups for a course, for a study, for a practice, a satsang, a sangha, basically doing what Kara and I are doing right here. It sort of feels like this, and you're all on Skype. It's anywhere from 5 to 10 people. But the curriculum is written to each person individually. So that's what's really
important. Do it. Tell your friends to do it. Tell everybody. Post it and repost it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we will come back with a part two of Game of Incarnation, if that's what we end up titling it as. And thank you so much, Kara, for navel-gazing with me.
We're just so good at it.
Oh, man. I love that. I love that term. All right, everybody. Thanks for being with Zooming in the Lens podcast. And go out there and find the visible within the invisible.
Enjoy the blood moon.
That's right. Absolutely. Take care. See you next time.
Bye.
When we experience the world around us, we identify with the subject, the knower. We don't identify with what we see. But as a matter of fact, if there is nothing seen, there is no experience of a seer. If there is no seer, there is no experience of anything seen. They both go together in the same way as the black and the white. And this idea that the yes and the no, the black and the white, the inside of a class, say we draw a square as representing fundamentally the idea of class. I can't have a square which doesn't have both inside and outside. They go together. And in Buddhism, this going together is called shunya. Although this is often translated void, it means that the inside of the square cannot exist, is void without the outside, the subject without the object, the black without the white. And this, of course, is represented in this fundamental Chinese figure of the yang, or the positive principle, and the yin, or the negative principle, like two fishes, constantly circulating, going round and round and round and round in the alternations of life. Now, the question is, are these two fishes involved in a fight? Is the white one eating up the black one, and the black one trying to eat up the white one? If that is the situation, then of course, life is fundamentally nothing but a grim contest. If this one up here is the good fellow, and this one is the bad fellow, if this is order and this is chaos, then a fight goes on between them. And that's largely the way in which our technology has interpreted man's situation as against nature. This is man, the white, the good fellow. This is nature, the dark, the bad fellow. And the white one has got to eat him up. But what happens if the white fish succeeds in eating up the dark fish? The white fish disappears as well as the dark one, because the white one is only there in relation to the dark. So then, if these two fishes, as it were, wake up, if this one wakes up and this one wakes up, which is called awakening in Buddhism, they realize they're one. In other words, they go together. They are inseparable from each other. And this realization is that experience, which is called in Zen, Satori, or in Buddhism, Bodhi, awakening. This sudden dawning on our consciousness that life is not really a contest to make yes triumph over no, to make the positive triumph over the negative. The two sides go together. And then one sees in this strange way that underlying all that is negative in the world, all that is in a way painful and evil, there is a kind of necessity to it. It goes with the good. It is necessary for the good. Disorder is necessary for the manifestation of order, just as you must have, say, a black background to show up a light figure. And then when one sees that, a profound transformation takes place in one's attitude to the world. That is to say, instead of looking upon life as a contest, it becomes a dance, it becomes a game. One doesn't withdraw from it, one doesn't stop living, but one goes into the game so that these revolving fishes are no longer trying to eat each other, but they're just going around dancing, having the biggest fun in the world.
Music and editing, special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.